I have a saying, money doesn't make you who you are, it makes you who you really are. Whatever passion that you're engaged in, it always gets bigger. And so managing that dynamic and then passing that through to the family is a challenge.
The greatest wealth transfer in history is currently underway, with somewhere between 80 to 100 trillion U.S. dollars in assets being transferred from baby boomers to the next generation. For the first time in history, according to data from UBS, inheritance accounted for more of the wealth that went into making new billionaires than successful entrepreneurship. For Bruce Lee, who manages the family offices for some of America's uber wealthy, this can be an opportunity and a curse. Bruce, thanks for joining us today from Las Vegas. What are you up to in Vegas? And please don't tell me that what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Okay, I won't. I'm actually in Las Vegas with ownership of a casino hotel called the Fontainebleau. And the ownership is an uber high net worth family called the Koch family, with Jeff Sofer and the Fontainebleau. So that's why we're here.
And so is that part of a, say, diversification strategy for the wealth that you're managing for the family? And what type of sort of entry strategy do you have or take on an investment such as this one?
Well, this is a large one. And I would be kidding you if I told you that this is what they do, they don't. But philosophically speaking, I think the family takes a look at things when they have an edge or access to an individual institution where they think that there's an opportunity. So if you kind of take three steps back and just from a broad perspective and take a look at, here we are going to get involved in a really more in the hospitality, because the casino aspect of it is, you know, casino gambling is really a small part now of Las Vegas.
Yeah, absolutely. And when it comes to those type of investments that involve real assets, we do see from the previous financial crisis that early vintage, capturing that time frame is very important. So now let's talk a little bit about the billionaire. So you've got those coming from entrepreneurship, but increasingly there's a new breed that are becoming instantly wealthy from an inheritance point of view. Is this happening just in the U.S. or do you see this happening all around the world?
Predominantly, it's in the United States. And so these kind of insta-millionaires, insta-billionaires are popping up everywhere in the United States. And it's tremendous right now. And it's only going to get bigger. You're talking about an age area where the individuals are between, let's say, 65 and 85 years old. And so you're seeing multi-generation families, billionaire families, multi-billionaire families that are about to inherit literally hundreds of millions of dollars, and how that affects their lives and behavior, for that matter.
What are some of the challenges dealing with ultra high net worth families?
I kind of have a saying, money doesn't make you who you are, it makes you who you really are. So if you're highly philanthropic, you become massively charitable and philanthropic. If you engaged in whatever passion that you're engaged in, it always gets bigger. And so managing that dynamic and then passing that through to the family is a challenge, because every single family has a different twist or a different look at things and how they view it. You know, where you'll be dealing with the patriarch, where they'll have this kind of business mindset. And then as that transfers down to the second and even a third generation, managing those dynamics are pretty intense. And so the challenge for individuals like myself or any advisors who are advising to those large families is transferring that intuition and monetizing it for them and keeping that dynamic together. And so that ecosystem is very, very difficult.
And let's narrow it down to the inheritance part. In the U.S. alone, more than $70 trillion is expected to be transferred from baby boomers to the next generation over the next 25 years. It's being billed as the greatest generational wealth transfer in history. And as a fund manager, what advice do you give this to the cohort of people who are going to suddenly become wealthy because of an inheritance?
You know, it's a problem in certain areas, but the way I kind of look at it is it always starts from education. And if you're not educating the individuals that are inheriting instantly the capital that they're about to receive, a lot of negative outcomes can occur from that. So I think from the beginning of literally when these children grow into, you know, young individuals and investors, they have to kind of know what their capital means to them and then what the vision of the family is. And so they're not necessarily looking for a cookie cutter approach. They're looking for a bespoke, customized approach relative to how their family dynamic wants to be expressed. And understanding the psychology of that, you have to be a very good listener in understanding what that means, because there's so many subtleties to those discussions. And that's where the challenge exists.
And obviously you've got the Koch brothers, as you mentioned, but a lot of your clients are families who've built wealth from less exciting ventures like chicken farms or waste management or real estate. How do you deal with people that have perhaps made a lot of money in a specific area, but then they know very little about finance or investing or outside of what they're familiar with?
You know, I would say the quick line to that is, you know, you want to transfer, or what I often say, you want to take the CEO of a company, whatever they do, and try to educate them to become the CEO of their capital. And so understanding all the factors that are involved in making money, either in the public markets or in the private markets, allows them to be better diversified and actually understand what that capital means. So some people don't even have an interest in money, and they're inheriting money. That's another challenge. So, you know, how do you deal with that? Some people reject money and they don't want nothing to do with money. I don't have this problem. But then they would say, well, I'm giving you this money. What do you want to do with it? And they say, well, I don't want it. And they're like, well, you have to take it. And so, you know, how do you deal with that human psychology behind it? So those are all the subtleties that waterfall into the overall discussion. And that's why scaling that business is very, very difficult, because every single family is bespoke in nature. If you're just advising them simply from the perspective of buy this, do that, and buy or sell products, the solution set is it doesn't monetize to the level of where they might want to go. So if they're primarily in real estate or whatever the case may be, you know, you want to educate them about what other asset classes mean and how they'll affect their net worth.
And when the families, when they come to you to manage their newfound wealth, what do you typically see in terms of their asset allocation? And from there, how do you advise them on modifying their portfolio?
That's a tough question, but I've noticed mostly that if they don't know what they're doing, cash seems to be a very predominant conversation relative to their asset allocation. Money markets, T-bills, treasuries, very basic, no risk type scenarios. And so moving slowly is a very critical component. Think about it. You make a lot of money, or you inherit a lot of money, and let's say an advisor comes along, well-intended, and you have an 08-like situation, right? And the family instantly loses a lot of money. That's nobody's fault necessarily, okay? But to instantly lose that capital and not know why, that usually creates a lot of anxiety.
Right.
So, you know, having cash and then slowly moving and while you're educating the client, I think is prudent on both ends. Because, you know, when you live in a dynamic world that we do that have top-down issues as well as bottom-up issues, again, clients don't want to lose money. They don't want to lose it quickly. And so, you know, to advise them in the most liquid investments is probably the wisest thing in the beginning while they're getting to understand what their capital means to them.
And I suppose that's also tied to sort of their investment horizon that they have in mind, which, can you speak a little bit to how that might differ from, say, an institutional investor?
Well, institutional investor has more of an investment mindset, and they're primarily professional in nature, okay? And they have their mandates established and their factors established. With ultra high net worth families, I generally find that they really don't know what they want, but they want a return. And so they're going into an ocean, for lack of better words, with a very small boat, and they have to understand what that means to them. It's actually a very high anxiety moment in time, because they went from being in total command of their business to now almost not having a real idea of the depth of what they need to do in order to make money in the marketplace.
Thanks, Bruce. Now let's check in with our resident expert, Alex Holmes from Oxford Economics. Alex, in Asia Pacific, we do see a lot of these generational wealth transfers taking place as well. Can you speak just a bit more about this?
Thanks, Pamela. Yeah, it's a fascinating question and one which I don't think the macro profession really has a solid handle on. What's really different from the past is the age profile of populations in the rich world. It used to be that older generations would have passed their wealth down to many children and grandchildren. But declining birth rates over the past 50 years means that in most of the rich world, the distribution of the population looks very different. It's kind of like an upside-down pyramid, with big cohorts of older generations at the top and increasingly smaller younger cohorts at the bottom. This is particularly true for aged societies like Japan and Germany and aging countries like China. So almost for the first time now, when wealth is being passed down, instead of diffusing, it is concentrating. The question then is, what does this do to economic incentives? Do those who receive massive windfalls keep working and innovating, or do they happily live off their passive income? And what does it do to inequality? There'll be a growing gap between those receiving big inheritances and those who do not. But how persistent will that be? There's this stereotype of children of rich families slacking off, and that wealth only lasts a few generations before it's frittered away. But that isn't really true in a general sense. Most effects of wealth, like the ability to have access to greater opportunities or to take greater risks through entrepreneurship, lead to its preservation. This is illustrated by one of my favorite economic papers. There was a couple of Italian academics who analyzed the Florentine tax census from 1427. And they found that the wealthiest in the city of Florence today are all the same families as they were 600 years ago. So wealth inequality is really, really enduring. And the challenge for governments across the globe over the coming decades is going to be, do you want to stop this? Can you? And if so, how?
Thank you so much, Alex. So Bruce, your dad was a professor, a math professor, if I'm not mistaken. What about having a dad as a maths professor that makes you take more of a mentor approach with your clients rather than a hand over your money to me and I'll manage it for you approach?
It's a great question. I mean, when you're brought up by a professor, a teacher, right? They're always asking you to come up with your own questions and then regress from there. So, you know, it just comes naturally, you know, as a son of a professor, to go to clients and try to be thoughtful in teaching your clients about how to make money and what to do, and then using the math to prove it to them.
Why do you think you operate this way? Did you learn this skill as an educator and mentor from your dad or from other places as well?
Yeah, sometimes I think my dad was sometimes a mentor and sometimes he just told me what to do. But, you know, from a logical perspective, I think what I learned most is you can't do things from an emotional perspective. You really have to, you know, prove it through the mathematics. And so something my father always told me, he goes, people lie, math doesn't. And so where I kind of synthesize that relative to what we do is when a client's telling you a certain thing and you can't provide the math behind it, it's your job to educate them of what that math means. So as an example, if a client says, I want to make a 20-30% rate of return, okay, but I don't want to take any risk, you have to provide that individual with why that's impossible. I mean, I'm taking an extreme, but I think you get the
right.
Get the example.
Those sounds like really great returns with really low risks.
Right. Yeah. That's what I want. Everyone wants to go to heaven. No one wants to die type strategy.
Exactly. Well, we are, since we're on the subject of families, they don't always get along, especially the ones that have a lot of assets involved. So when you have these family offices, I imagine your role is as much about being a counselor as a financial advisor.
I think you have to be a counselor first, candidly. I think it's a big game of psychology. Understanding the family dynamic is probably the single most critical component in understanding families. And especially when you're getting engaged in, I wouldn't say necessarily the secrets, but the desires of the family and what they want to do. And then understanding the family dynamics and understanding the subtleties of how to handle each situation. And then you can provide, you know, the investment counseling and so on and so forth. And oh, by the way, every family member needs to be communicated to differently, which is challenging.
Right. Now, there's this concept of family offices, which a lot of ultra high net worths will set up, or multifamily offices where they will pool capital. How do you advise people on whether or not to go down that route?
It depends on what the family's looking to do, but historically speaking, on a single family office situation or multifamily office situation, it is dealing with generational wealth. So, and, you know, I can't give you the dollar amount, but, you know, you can kind of go from there. But if it's multi-generational, the alignment or the opportunity for a single family office or a multifamily office usually evolves from that, because you need to professionalize the money.
Now, so for people who don't have a family office as such, but have acquired considerable wealth, what's your general advice for balancing a portfolio that's going to grow wealth for the coming generations? Because a lot of it is about succession planning.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the way I look at it is, you know, kind of three areas, you know, foundation, construction, and then somewhat of access to the type of investments that you want to get engaged with. And so if they're not going to get engaged in a single family office or whatever the case may be, keep it simple. Keep the structure super simple. Make sure that, you know, everybody understands kind of what they're about to receive and how they're going to receive it, and only do things that's fully around the investment opportunity.
And also, what if it was the dad or granddad or grandma who set up the business and built the family wealth? How do you deal with the child or the grandchild that didn't play a role in accumulating that wealth and perhaps don't have the knowledge or even maturity to manage that money?
That's probably the toughest question that you can ask, because it involves emotion, right? So, it depends kind of on the family dynamic. If there's a very, I don't mean to sound so holistic on it, but if it's a very loving family, I think it's somewhat easier. But if it's somewhat of a caustic relationship, that translation becomes a lot more difficult.
And what would be the way you educate them about risk-adjusted return? Because I think that is difficult to qualify and quantify oftentimes.
So I kind of simplify it, you know, you know, because the question's been asked before. Well, I just want to make money, and I would say to the patriarch, I'd say, well, you ran a business, right? If you had one customer, but you were growing at 100% a year, that's a pretty good return. Would you rather have one client and grow at 100% a year, or would you rather have 10 clients and grow at 20% a year? And, you know, the most of the answer would be, I'd rather have 10 clients and grow at 20% a year because it's more sustainable. I go, you just explained your portfolio.
And finally, what's the best piece of advice you've heard for wealth management?
The best piece of advice I heard was actually from my mother, which was, don't follow the politics, let the politics follow you. And oftentimes when you have a lot of money, you know, people get involved in the politics, either the politics of their family members, the politics of investments, dealing with various types of pieces of advice. And I think to have a single vision of what you want to be and where you want to aspire to be helps drive the conversation a lot better. So that's kind of the best advice I have for people.
Well, thank you very much. That was our special guest, Bruce Lee, founder of Keyback Wealth Management, and our resident expert, Alex Holmes from Oxford Economics. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And thanks for tuning in to episode 4 of I See Your Trade, season 4. I See Your Trade is brought to you by IC Markets, a leading high-performance trading provider. Trade up to IC Markets. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.